Good morning and welcome back. Today we are going to explore a proposed answer to the Christological questions that we've been studying over the last few weeks. We've seen how the church, from the very beginning, wrestled to understand both the deity and the humanity of Christ. And we saw that the Council of Chalcedon, as a result of these Christological controversies, laid down the boundary markers for orthodoxy. Namely, that in Christ there is one person who exists in two natures. One person in two natures. And that any Christological speculation, if it is to avoid the rocks of orthodoxy, must steer a course down this channel marked by those parameters of Chalcedon, that we must neither divide the person nor confuse the natures of Christ. Now, having reviewed over the last few weeks, briefly, some of the high points, some of the mountain peaks of Christological speculation down through the centuries, I'm going to try to formulate this morning, or to begin to formulate, a rational, coherent doctrine of the person of Christ. Now, before I do so, let me emphasize that in presenting this, I am not claiming that this is what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches that Christ is human and divine, and that he is one person. But the question is, how can we coherently formulate such a doctrine so as to make this intelligible? And in order to do that, we offer a possible model that will affirm in a rational and coherent way the basic standards of orthodoxy, that Christ is one person in two natures. I'm not presenting this as the gospel truth, but simply as a model, a possible model that is consistent with the biblical data and which makes rational sense. And this is of apologetic importance in that it would then remove any objection to the doctrine of Christianity that says that the notion that Christ is both God and man is an impossible contradiction, that Christianity is incoherent and therefore cannot be rationally affirmed. In order to defeat that objection, all that the Christian defender needs to do is to propose some possible model of the incarnation, according to which Christ is both God and man in one person, which is a coherent explanation of the doctrine. Whether or not it's true, we cannot presume to say. We cannot dogmatize about this, but we can give a possible and plausible model of the incarnation, and that is enough to defeat objections to the coherence of Christian theism. So, number one then, with respect to this model, I want to postulate with the Council of Chalcedon that in Christ there are two natures united in one person. So we want to affirm with the Council of Chalcedon that in the incarnation there is one person who exemplifies two distinct and complete natures, a human nature and a divine nature. So the model that I'm going to lay out is along the lines of Chalcedonian orthodoxy, one person with two complete and distinct natures, one human and one divine. Now, as we look back on this debate, in one sense, the Alexandrian theologians were right in postulating a single nature in Christ. That is to say, the individual person, Jesus Christ, has an individual essence which serves to mark him out uniquely and designate just that individual, who is Jesus Christ. But when the framers of the doctrine or the statement of Chalcedon affirmed that there are two natures in Christ, they weren't talking about a kind of individual essence that each individual person exemplifies, but rather they were talking about what were called kind essences or natures. divine essences or natures. These would be essences which would mark off natural kinds of things. And anything belonging to that natural kind would have the same nature as any other thing belonging to that kind. For example, according to Aristotle, human beings have the nature of rational animal. To be a rational animal is to be a human being. This is the nature of humanity. Human beings are animals, but they are a very special kind of animals. They are rational animals. And that is the very nature of what it is to be a human being. Dogs and cats may be animals, but they belong to different natural kinds. And a dog is not rational, therefore is not a human being. A cat is not rational, therefore it's not a human being. Angels are rational, but they're not animals, and therefore angels belong to different natural kinds. So there are lots of different natural kinds in the world. Humans, dogs, cows, pigs, cats, and so forth. And these all have different natures, which every member of that natural kind possesses. So in affirming that Christ had two natures, the church fathers were stating that Christ had all of the properties that go to constitute humanity and all the properties which go to make up deity. And in that sense, he had two natures. And therefore, he belonged to two natural kinds, namely, to the natural kind God and to the natural kind man. He had a complete man nature, and he had a complete God nature. And therefore, he belonged, in a sense, to two natural kinds of things. And these two natures are distinct in that they don't combine with each other in order to make up a single new natural kind, say a God-man or something like that. They don't combine or fuse together to make up a new natural kind that Christ exemplifies. That would mean that if that were true, then Christ was neither God nor man, but some third thing, something that was neither God nor man, but was some sort of a strange fusion of humanity and deity. It would also mean that the attributes of humanity would be essential to the Logos, the second person of the Trinity, because Christ is the Logos. He is the second person of the Trinity, and so if he had this fusion, this third sort of nature, and that belonged to him, then it would follow that the Logos, in becoming incarnate, had changed in his nature, and it had ceased to be divine, that he was no longer God because he gave up the divine nature and became something else. But only the divine nature belongs essentially to the Logos. The Logos thus had a divine nature essentially, and then took on contingently the human nature. So the Logos, the second person of the Trinity, has these two natures, these two kinds to which he belongs, the one essentially being God, and the other contingently being man. He didn't have to become incarnate, he didn't have to become a man, but he chose to do so. So he has the one kind of nature essentially, and the other kind of nature contingently. So Christ's individual essence, that is to say, now reverting to the idea of an essence that marks Jesus Christ out as an individual human being, had some of the properties which serve to constitute humanity, such as rationality, essentially, because God is also essentially rational, but he had some of these properties only contingently. For example, animality, having an animal body, he possessed only contingently. So what I'm arguing here in the first point is that Christ is one person who is the Logos, the second person of the Trinity, and he possesses two distinct natures or kind essences, one essentially and one contingently. Now this first point entails a rejection of any form of canonic Christology, which suggests that in the incarnation, the Logos surrendered any attributes which belong to the divine nature. You'll remember that canonic Christology from the last time we met together is the view that in the incarnation, Christ surrenders certain attributes so as to become human, that he does not possess unchanged a divine nature and then takes on, in addition to that, a human nature. Rather, canonic Christology says that the Logos changed in his nature, that he somehow gave up certain attributes that were his in the pre-incarnate state and then took on other attributes in order to become a human being. But if Christ divested himself in the incarnation of any attribute that was essential to deity, it would follow that he thereby ceased to be God. If Christ surrendered any attribute essential to deity in the incarnation, then in becoming incarnate, he would cease to be God. And that is not only incompatible with the biblical data, which ascribes deity to the incarnate Christ, but it would also be, I think, unacceptable with respect to the doctrine of Chalcedon, which says that in becoming incarnate, Christ is both God and man. The Christian doctrine is not that Christ turned himself into a human being. Rather, the Christian doctrine is that Christ added to the divine nature that he already had an additional human nature which he has not had from eternity. Now, on these canonic views, according to which the Logos surrenders his essential divine attributes, it would be true that after the kenosis, or emptying — kenosis is the Greek word that means emptying — it would be true that after the emptying of the divine attributes, he would remain the same person that he was before the kenosis, but that person would no longer be God. Because one's deity is not determined by the person, it's determined by the nature. So that if the person, who is the second person of the Trinity, divested himself of any divine attributes in becoming incarnate, while he would still be the same person after the incarnation as before, he would no longer be God. He will have given up attributes essential to deity and therefore would have ceased to be God, which is simply not the doctrine of the incarnation. Now, the canonicist might try to avert those problems, as I said last time, by denying that attributes like omnipotence, omniscience, eternality, omnipresence, and so forth are essential to deity. He might say these are merely accidental products of the second person of the Trinity, accidental properties, that is to say, and therefore they could have been given up without Christ's ceasing to be God. These attributes are not essential to deity, and therefore if the Logos gives up omnipresence, omnipotence, omniscience, and so forth, then this doesn't mean that he ceases to be divine in becoming incarnate. When you think about it, however, I think that this sort of Christology exacts far too high a price to be acceptable. Just think about it a little bit. What kind of concept of God are you going to be left with if you say that those properties that I've just listed are not essential to God? It would mean that a being could lack those properties and still be God. That is to say, on canonic Christology, there is a possible world in which a being exists who is no more powerful, no more intelligent, no less limited than, say, Mary and Beck, and yet would be God, and therefore would be worthy of worship. And that surely seems incredible. Surely a being which did not possess those sorts of properties, like omnipotence, omnipresence, eternality, and so forth, would not be God and would not be worthy of worship. This is far too weak and thin a conception of God to be plausible. Now, some contemporary defenders of canonic Christology have tried to avoid this objection by saying that God may lack the essential properties of omnipotence, omniscience, omnipresence, and so forth. But while he doesn't have those properties, he does have essentially properties like being omniscient, except when canonically incarnate. And the hyphens are supposed to indicate that this is all one property. This is one big fancy property. God does not have essentially the property of being omniscient, but he does have the property of being omniscient except when canonically incarnate. And therefore, God doesn't give up these attributes. He has attributes like being omnipotent except when canonically incarnate, being omnipresent except when canonically incarnate, being eternal except when canonically incarnate. And these fancy hyphenated attributes are essential to God and are never given up because he still has them even when he gives up omniscience, omnipotence, eternality conceived in a simple way. I think this escape route, however, is really utterly implausible. In the first place, I think that it tends to confuse real properties with merely grammatical predicates. It confuses real properties with merely grammatical predicates. Let me give an illustration. Take the property being human. That seems to be a real property which certain things possess. Steve Cousins has this property of being human, but by contrast, this eraser does not possess that property, neither does his podium. They don't have the property being human. But what about the predicate not being a whale? Not being a whale. If we say that this is a genuine property, then this is a property which not only Steve Cousins possesses, but this eraser also has the property of not being a whale, and the podium has the property of not being a whale. And yet this seems utterly implausible. This is not a genuine property that the eraser has, like being black, being rectangular, being in a certain substance or material. This is merely a grammatical predicate that is true when ascribed to the eraser, namely, the eraser is not a whale. That's true when you assign that predicate to the eraser. The eraser is not a whale. Similarly, the podium is not a whale. But that's not a real property that the eraser possesses. Steve Cousins has the real property of being a human, but he doesn't have the real property not being a whale. That's a mere predicate that is true of him. And exactly the same way, these fancy, highfalutin, hyphenated properties aren't real properties. These are just predicates masquerading as properties, which are supposedly true of the Logos. These are true on canonic Christology, but the Logos is omniscient except when canonically incarnate. And if these are not real properties, then it follows that he does give up the essential properties to deity, namely omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence, and so forth, and therefore really isn't God, even though you can attribute these grammatical predicates to the Logos at any time. I think this is especially clear when you consider that this escape route from the objection to canonic Christology is really quite empty or vacuous when it comes to offering an explanation of how God can become man. In answer to the question, how can God remain God if he gives up the attribute of omniscience, we're told that it's because he retains the essential property of being omniscient except when canonically incarnate. And that doesn't explain anything. That's just to reiterate the mystery to be explained, namely how God can remain God if he gives up omniscience. Let me give a parallel illustration. Imagine a case in which a human being is said to have given up all of the properties that are incompatible with his becoming an ant. He gives up all of his human properties that are incompatible with his turning into an ant, and yet it's said that he remains a human being. If we objected that rationality is essential to being human, and that therefore in giving up rationality he had ceased to be human, would it be a satisfactory answer to say that only rationality except when canonically an ant is essential to being a human, and that he retains that property even in his ant state? Even after turning himself into an ant, he still has the property of being rational except when canonically an ant. Well, I think it's very clear that wouldn't explain anything. It would merely reassert the original problem. So it seems to me that these contrived properties are not really properties at all. They're just predicates masquerading as properties. They're really just assertions to the effect that Christ remains divine even though he gives up omniscience. And that's the very question to be explained. That's the very issue under dispute. How can Christ remain divine if he gives up properties like omniscience, omnipresence, omnipotence, and so forth? Moreover, it is not clear at all that the problem of the incarnation is solved even by postulating these sort of gerrymandered properties, because I think certain divine attributes cannot be temporarily divested in the way that canonic theologians imagine. For example, take the attribute of omnipotence, that God is all-powerful. It seems incoherent to say that during the incarnation, Christ retained the property of being omnipotent except when canonically incarnate. Because if he relinquished omnipotence, if he gave up omnipotence in order to become incarnate, but he retained the power to get omnipotence back again, then he didn't really, in fact, cease to be omnipotent. Because omnipotence is a power about what you can do. And if Christ had the ability during the incarnation to get omnipotence back again, then he still had the ability to do everything that an omnipotent being can do, and therefore he really was omnipotent all the time. So you can't really give up omnipotence while retaining the ability to get it back again. You would still be omnipotent. So I don't think it makes sense to say that Christ has the essential property of being omnipotent except when canonically incarnate. He either is or he is not omnipotent, and trying to gerrymander it in this way won't work with omnipotence, because omnipotence is merely the ability to do something, and if he had the power to get it back again, then he still had that ability. Or consider properties of the divine nature like God's necessity, that God exists necessarily, or his aseity, which is that God exists independently, he is self-existent, or God's eternity, which is that God exists without beginning and end, he is permanent. What about necessity, aseity, and eternality? Does it make any sense to say that these sorts of attributes were given up temporarily? Well, I don't think so, because by their very nature, if you have these properties, you have them permanently. If you exist necessarily, then you cannot give up that property, because you have it forever. If you're self-existent, you can't cease to be self-existent for a time. Or if you're eternal, again, obviously, you cannot cease to be eternal for a time. It makes no sense to say that these properties are given up merely temporarily. But if Christ did not give these properties up, if Christ retained these properties during the state of humiliation, during the incarnation, as it seems that he must do, then how could Christ die? How could Christ die on the cross if he still retained properties of necessity, aseity, and eternality? It seems to me that one is forced to say that, well, Christ died only in his human nature, and these attributes are preserved in the divine nature, that the divine nature of Christ remains necessary as aseity and is eternal, but it's the human nature of Christ which dies on the cross. But then if the canonic theologian is forced to go that route, then why not say that about all of the other attributes as well, like omnipotence, omniscience, omnipresence, and all the rest? That Christ retains those attributes in the divine nature, but he does not have them in the human nature. In other words, we have reverted back to Chalcedonian Christology, not canonic Christology. That is to say, we are affirming that Christ has two complete and unadulterated natures: a divine nature, which possesses necessity, aseity, eternality, omnipresence, omnipotence, and omniscience, and is unchanged in the incarnation, and he has a complete and true human nature, which possesses properties like mortality, spatial limitedness, temporality, limited power, limited knowledge, and so forth. So it seems to me that canonic Christology is really a non-starter, and that we do best to stick with Chalcedonian Christology, which says that in Christ there is a single person, the second person of the Trinity, the Logos, who possesses two complete natures, one human and one divine, the divine nature essentially and the human nature contingently in virtue of the incarnation. Now that's step one in our proposed model. Next Sunday, we will turn to the second step, in which I will try to explain how one person can have two complete natures, one human and one divine. So until next time, we'll see you then.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig.